Welcome to this week's commentary on the current economic scene. This for the week of February 25th. With us again this week is Professor Paul Samuelson from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Professor Samuelson, first of all, how do you stand in the great guessing game that is going on at the moment? Will the prime rate move, and which way will it go when it does move?
My guess, for what it's worth, is that the next move of the prime rate will be definitely upward. This rate, which is what banks charge to their best customers, is now 7%. The discount rate of the Federal Reserve is 5.5%. The actual going rate for euro dollars, which the banks have been relying upon to a great extent, is over 8%. As the president of the First National Bank of Boston, Mr. Damon, said recently, something has to give. I think maybe a couple of things will have to give, and one of them, I suspect, will be the prime rate. I shouldn't be surprised, I ought to add, that we'd get another twist of the screw with respect to the discount rate, because, make no mistake about it, we are now in a period of tight money by any definition. I had predicted on these tapes that we would have more of this, and I have to simply reiterate that. I expect interest rates to harden even farther before they go down again. Now, why do I think the prime rate will go up? I think it will go up because the demand for credit on the part of customers, I think, is still very strong. On the other hand, the supply of credit, which the banks have to dole out to those customers, is being severely squeezed. There was a conference board meeting last week that some of you may have attended or read about in the newspapers, and there was considerable testimony at that meeting that an uncomfortable process of credit rationing is now going on. Walter Hoadley of the Bank of America on the West Coast, the largest bank in the country and in the world, said that they have put in a new order of rationing. There are many loan purposes which previously had been honored, which today will not be honored if you go to your branch manager or even to central headquarters of the Bank of America. Activities as takeover activities, which always are regarded as having something of the unsavory in them, as against the, and I quote now from the 1913 Federal Reserve Act, the legitimate credit needs of business, agriculture, and manufacturing, commerce, agriculture, and manufacturing, they're clamping down. Well, if they're clamping down on those purposes, you can be sure that the definition of what is creditworthy is rapidly changing. I think the prime rate has already, in a hidden way, gone up. The marginal firms who sometimes qualify for the prime rate are, this very day, not qualifying for the prime rate. And most of the firms who do qualify for the prime rate are finding that it's good diplomacy to keep a larger compensating balance, idle, earning no interest with the banker who's extending that prime rate to you. But explicitly, I would expect it to go up. One more straw in the wind. At this same conference board meeting, a first vice president of the prestigious New York Federal Reserve Bank spoke out candidly to the assembled bankers there and told them to ration their credit more tightly. He said mere creditworthiness isn't any longer enough, and he implied that the social purpose required that they squeeze down pretty hard. Well, their self-interest in a time of limited funds demands that they squeeze down pretty hard, and they will, and their self-interest, to my mind, suggests that over a longer period of time, instead of rationing the credit by a non-market mechanism, which means that you make a free gift to the lucky fellow who happens to qualify for the rationed item, and you deprive an almost equally worthy person of any advantage by refusing him a loan completely or cutting his loan down drastically. A more profitable and a more even-handed way of doing it would be to raise the rate for everybody to that rate which clears the market. And I think that that process is going on. I think it will go on more in the future. I would like to comment on one other matter. One of our subscribers in a telephone call to me said that he had read the famous article by Ed Dale in the New York Times of a few weeks ago, in which he spoke about the big joke that's going around everywhere in knowing circles, the object of laughter being the Federal Reserve. All of us sophisticated people are saying ha 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 at the stupid, comical Federal Reserve. And he asked me, what about that? What is the joke? Because although he's a fairly prominent New York banker, he wasn't in on it. I hate to confess my provincial ignorance, but I said to him, well, you know, I'm not in on it either, but I'll find out. And so when I went to some New York meetings where the real elite of the financial world were, I said to them, what's the big joke that we're all laughing about? And each one confessed that he didn't know either. It was the case of the emperor's clothes. Nobody wanted to admit that he wasn't in on this, but nobody really knew what it was all about. It's the way some of us feel when we're at a very sophisticated dinner party and such terribly, terribly amusing stories are told in French, and our graduate student knowledge of French, which is pretty rusty, doesn't do us good service, and so we nervously laugh along with the crowd. I thought, well, then I'll go down to Washington, and I'll find out from sophisticated people there what the big joke is, and it turned out that they didn't know. Then I went to the Federal Reserve, and they felt a little bit, I think, like a professor when the class suddenly snickers and you look down to see whether all your buttons are buttoned. They weren't sure just what the joke was. Well, Dale didn't tip his hand, which is a very good idea, I think, in this case. He indicated that part of the joke was that although the Fed was squeezing, the banks were responding to that squeeze by using euro dollars. Well, I don't know what's so novel about that. I don't know what's so comical about that. It's exactly what one would have expected from economic law to happen. It has been happening to a considerable degree, and the joke of the joke is that just as Dale was writing, their turning to euro dollars was not sufficient to offset the squeeze by the Federal Reserve, because now that we have the first few weeks' figures of the credit base and the money supply and the growth of the credit proxy and all these matters, we find that there has been a severe a squeeze. The other thing, which is just hinted on in the Dale article, would have to do with something more interesting and even more serious, namely that the Fed thinks it's squeezing and is looking at the wrong variables, such as interest rates, and in fact isn't squeezing, because if you looked at the right variable, such as the rate of growth of the money supply, you would find that money wasn't tight. Well, at the time that Dale was writing, and for some time earlier than that, you couldn't say that. If that had been the intention of the joke, and if it had been written back in July or even back in November, then one might have had a little innocent merriment at the expense of the Fed, and I may say it couldn't happen to a nicer bunch of guys, on this particular point. So I conclude that my subscribers had better call up Ed Dale personally and find out from him what it is that we all are laughing at.
Professor Samuelson, do you think that the recent weakness in the stock market has anything to do with new Nixon policies?
I never pretend that I can explain the movements of the stock market before the fact. Actually, I never claim that I can explain the movements of the stock market after the fact, although there are many more who feel themselves eligible to that task than to the earlier task. However, I'll just speculate, if I may use that word, on the matter. I believe that the testimony by Paul McCracken and by members of the Council of Economic Advisers and by the Treasury indicating that the surtax would in all likelihood be maintained after July 1st was noted by the market. I find it hard to believe that such a sophisticated group as Wall Street would consider this to be new news at this time and would not have discounted and rediscounted that particular bit of news in advance. But I suppose every increase in one's confidence in a bit of news is an essential change in one's information pattern. So that could be a part of the argument. The second is a little bit broader and a little bit perhaps more ideological. The testimony by the council advisors and by various Treasury officials has indicated that there is a real serious concern on the part of the Nixon administration about the current rate of inflation. And there is a willingness to pay something in the way of cost to slow down that rate of inflation. Now, the cost has to do with overall unemployment, has to do with unemployment among the marginal groups who suffer the highest rate of unemployment, and has something to do with the rate of real growth of the American economy in the period ahead. With officials making noises like that, I suppose that that would be a market influence. But again, this is not a new element, and one would have thought that much of it would be discounted. Perhaps what is new about it is that when the new team came in at the very first, there seemed to be a soft peddling of that kind of talk beyond what would really be credible to any sophisticated observer. And so perhaps the market was reminded of something which it had wished in a Freudian fashion to push to the back of its mind. Third, and now we're getting back to the first topic I discussed, which is the state of the interest rate picture. I think that the sophisticated forecasters of business activity have themselves now become convinced on the basis of a few weeks rather severe tightness by the Federal Reserve that the Federal Reserve does mean business, and that the Federal Reserve means business not just for another few weeks, but that this may be a long campaign right throughout the year of a tighter money by any one of the definitions. And so this is causing some of them, perhaps, to make some write-downs in their quarterly estimates of the gross national product, in some estimates on housing in particular late in the year. And what's very important to stock market analysts, perhaps some write-downs in the pattern of corporate profits, which they envisage over the next 6 or 8 quarters. It's that picture with respect to profits that is quite important, presumably, for the determination of stock values. Now, I don't know how important that has been. If we take housing as an example, we've had a really startling first month figures in January. Housing starts shot up to 1.8 million housing starts, which is perhaps their all-time record, and certainly the highest they've been for a long, long time, and more than one would have been expected, one would have expected on the basis of the slight faltering in housing, which was detectable towards the end of last year. I don't think we should make too much of any 1 month's figures, and certainly don't make too much of January figure, because it's a seasonally corrected figure, and it's pretty much a phantom figure. I can't remember whether it's 8,000 starts blown up by seasonal correction, but except in the South and in the West, January is not a good building month, and you may get a nice seasonally corrected figure, but it doesn't actually serve as a token of very much that is happening. Moreover, there's a technical factor one has to watch out for. You would think that the technicians would be paid to watch out for it for us, but apparently they don't take this into account in their report. There were 22 working days in January. That is not a recurring January phenomenon. That's a day more than happens in many Januaries. And since they make a seasonal correction only for the January-ness of January and do not divide by the number of working days, you have a fictitious element of 1 in 22. That's up to almost 5% increase that could be a purely fictitious one, and that means that 1.7 million housing starts might be just as good a figure as 1.8 million. Nevertheless, I take this to be a straw in the wind that credit availability has not yet become too terribly restrictive in the markets which are open weather-wise for building, and I regard this as an indication of strength in the first part of the year for housing. I think that strength in the first part of the year will be taxed quite severely by the problem of credit availability later. Well, all the glosses I've been making up till now on the possible causes for the degree of weakness that we've seen in the stock market in the last couple of weeks have had to do with the possibility of a slowdown in the rate of growth of business due to policies of the new administration or policies of the new-look Federal Reserve Board. But there is a more direct effect which ought to be mentioned in connection with the tightening of interest rates. Bonds are competitors for stocks. And interest rates can be thought of as kind of an inverted price-earnings ratio. It's a price-earnings ratio for a bond, but the earning, of course, is the coupon of the bond. If you can get 5, 6% on a tax-exempt municipal bond, then you can get that today on some quite good tax-exempt municipal bonds. You have to feel, as a high-bracket taxpayer, that you're pretty smart these days in picking out conglomerate equities that are going to give you capital gains that will end you up after taxes better off than that. And I don't have to talk simply about tax exempts. You're getting a sweeter yield on mortgages and on all kinds of alternative investments to equities. So at the margin, as we economists say, where you are deciding between what percentage of your portfolio you should put in equities and what percentage you should put in, let's say, short-term bonds with the high interest rates that short-term bonds are now paying and which I may point out, are almost free of any default risk and are almost free of any decline in principal, because interest rates will harden in accordance with my own forecast. They're almost free of that because they're very short term. Well, that does change the marginal amount of money that is going into the stock market. If the effect that I'm talking about, the competitive effect of interest yields upon investment in equities, doesn't affect you directly, you may be one of these chaps who says, well, it'll affect other people, and therefore it must affect me indirectly. There's plenty of superficial evidence that tight money, measured by high and growing interest rates, even when the outlook for business is very strong, and I think 1966 would be a case. Let's take a date like August of 1966 or July of 1966. All of the forecasts that were going through Wall Street were for a strong outlook for business ahead, so strong that those people recommended and went along with a recommendation that the investment tax credit be suspended, an act which took place only a couple months later in September. But money was very tight at that time, and we did have weakness in the Dow Jones averages. I should warn you, and I should remind myself, that we don't know in 1966 that the tightness of money was the proximate cause of the mid-year weakness in the stock market, because we have no controlled experiment on that. Still, people in Wall Street, whose judgment I've learned to respect in the past, at that time were giving weight to that causal factor, and the subsequent pattern of events suggests that they may have had a point. I put it forward for your consideration here.
Professor Samuelson, we've been hearing a great deal of talk lately about tax reform. Do you have any views on this subject for our listeners?
That's a very, very large topic, and I don't think that in the time that is left to me today, I can more than scratch the surface, but let me say a few things about it. First, I want to remind myself that a little bit of the day-to-day weakness in the stock market might have come about because of a little jolt that the market got when it read the news on the tape that in the testimony of the Secretary of Treasury and Undersecretaries of Treasury, there seemed to be, for the first time under consideration, an actual suspension of the investment tax credit. In September of 1966, the investment tax credit was suspended as a new weapon in our arsenal of business cycle control. And the Secretary of Treasury and his undersecretaries, in response to a question, I believe, from Representative Royce of Milwaukee, said, yes, along with the problem of continuation of the 10% surtax, which was under consideration and reconsideration, there was under consideration a suspension of the investment tax credit. That could make quite a bit of difference to the earnings of railroads and quite a number of industrial concerns. Now, that could go under the heading of tax reform. Let me give you a wild guess in this matter. I think I know the records of Charles Walker, the Undersecretary of the Treasury, and David Kennedy, the Secretary of the Treasury, and I do not believe that at any time they have had under serious consideration at all a suspension of the investment tax credit. This goes counter to Republican philosophy at its core. This is a typical John F. Kennedy, New Frontier kind of gimmick. And I can say that in all good faith because it's my kind of gimmick. It's the kind of thing that I very strongly recommend, but I don't think I could persuade good old Charles Walker of the wisdom of this. So corporate controllers and accountants and treasurers, sleep well tonight. Professor Samuelson assures you with great probability that after this reconsideration of the surcharge is made, the new team in the United States Treasury will decide that it's in the best interest of long-term growth of the United States not to change it. Now, let me turn very briefly to the problem of general tax reform. In a later tape, I'd like to expand on this, but if you wanted to get in mind very clearly what it is that typical experts in public finance think is wrong with our present tax system, which loopholes the academic professors of public finance regard as abhorrent, I suggest that you get hold of the report of the Commission on Taxation from our neighbor in Canada. Royal Commission was held. It took testimony. It met over a long period of time. It deliberated, and it came out with what must be regarded as a splendid report by academic experts in the field of taxation. I may add, just in case I frightened you by this, by saying that it has not been legislated by our Canadian neighbors, nor do I see any prospect that most of its features will be so legislated, because it's too good, in this case, to be politically acceptable. If I were to give a single example of a loophole which is deemed most inequitable and most in need of being closed up by academic experts on public finance, what will leap to your mind is 27.5% oil depletion. Well, that isn't at all what I have in mind. I think that in the words of the dean of the Harvard Law School, who is now the Solicitor General of the United States and who may become the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, Irwin Griswold, oil stinks. But it's precisely because oil stinks so loud, to mix the metaphor, in the field of taxes, that politically it would be dynamite to remove the depletion. And you may have noticed that in all of the discussions by the Treasury in discussing tax reform, one of the opening depositions has been, we will not at this point touch the oil depletion problem. Well, bad cess to them for that, but that is the case. The loophole that I have in mind is the loophole in capital gains taxation. If I have General Motors stock and it goes up in price, and I don't sell it, I don't have to pay any tax because I have not realized the capital gains. If I do sell it, and if I've held it more than 6 months, I pay tax at a very light rate, relatively light rate. Instead of my very high marginal tax rate, I pay in this year at a 27.5% rate at most. But there's an even bigger loophole, aside from my waiting to realize it until it pleases my fancy. Namely, I can wait until I die and have that General Motors stock pass in my estate. Now, that stock in my estate, like any other item in my estate, will be subject to estate and inheritance taxation. I know 1,000 gimmicks for lessening that, but that's another story. However, it will escape forever capital gain taxation. My heirs, my widow, my numerous children will get good old daddy's General Motors stock, which he bought at a price of $1 and which is now worth $100 a share, and has a $99 of capital gains tax liability on it. They get it free of any of that liability. It's just washed out at my death. There is no taxation. Well, you'd be surprised how much escapes taxation ever by this particular loophole. And so in Canada, they would like to get rid of that feature. And for many, many years, the United States Treasury has made recommendations trying to get rid of that feature. it's very important to get rid of it, but the Congress of the United States, which consists of elderly gentlemen in part who have themselves stocks like this or know people like this, have never deemed it in the interests of the country to close this loophole. And quite candidly, I don't really think it'll be in a Nixon administration that we see this loophole closed.
Thank you, Professor Paul Samuelson of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. IDI welcomes your comments, questions, or suggestions. Simply write to IDI, 166 East Superior Street, Chicago 60611.